All right. Well, good morning. And thank you for joining us and braving the elements and coming out today. As I was mentioning to the panelists, we know that the folks who showed up today are the ones who really care about these issues. So, again, thanks for being here. My name is John Delacorte, and I want to welcome you on behalf of the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group of the Federalist Society to today's program on the second anniversary of the Class Action Fairness Act. As you all know, the act was signed into law by President Bush on February 18th of 2005, and while it hasn't been an enormous amount of time since the act has been in effect, it's been long enough that it is appropriate at this point to make some preliminary assessments, so that's what we'd like to do today. In particular, we'd like to evaluate some of the key provisions. What has been the effect of expanded federal court jurisdiction? Has there been a significant impact on settlements? In particular, are we seeing better quality settlements and settlements that are delivering more actual value to the class members? And finally, what has been the effect on the so-called magic jurisdictions? Does that continue to be a problem, or is it something that has been addressed? So before we begin, I should give you some of my own background. I am, I think the reason I was invited to be the moderator today is, in addition to my charm and good looks, is that in my former life at the Federal Trade Commission, I served as the chief antitrust counsel of the Office of Policy Planning, and one of our initiatives there was to conduct some research into the class action world. Our effort was termed the Class Action Fairness Act, and it particularly focused on the issue of settlements and what could be done to ensure that they were fair to consumers. So I think some of these folks on our panel today participated in that effort. I thank them for that, and I look forward to their thoughts this morning. So with that, I'll turn it over to our first panelist, which will be John Beisner. John is a partner at O'Melveny & Myers here in Washington, D.C. He is the head of the firm's class action, mass torts, and aggregated litigation practice. John has extensive litigation experience and extensive class action experience at all levels. And of particular relevance to the panel this morning, John testified before both the House and the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding the Class Action Fairness Act. So, John.
Thank you very much. I was going to start today with just a little bit of a refresher as to the purposes of the statute. I won't get into much detail about the actual provisions, which I think most of you are probably quite familiar with at this point, but just to take a quick tour back through a rather extensive and detailed legislative history about what was Congress concerned about in enacting this legislation. Some of them were just mentioned, just to raise a few. I do think that a primary motivator was the issue of magnet state courts, that the recognition that class actions under the pre-CAFA regime were really universal venue lawsuits. If you had a major controversy, you could file your nationwide class action in virtually any state court, and so those who were filing these actions would find the forum in which they most wanted to litigate for whatever strategic reasons they had in mind, and not surprisingly, there turned out to be several of jurisdictions, Madison County, Illinois being the one that most frequently comes to mind, where these class actions were focused. We talk a lot about Madison County, but I would note that other state courts along the way had that title. I remember when we first started talking about the legislation, the focus was actually on Alabama and the discovery there of one state court judge who, upon review of the record, had certified as many classes over the course of a year as had all federal judges combined. I need to make a few footnotes of those statistics, but he was certifying classes at a, needless to say, rapid rate, which drew notice and therefore drew a lot more class actions. A second concern that I think Congress was addressing was the issue of copycat class actions, that the problem of when a new controversy emerged,
counsel interested in filing cases would file them in a variety of different locations, and many of those counsel would file more than one. And so if you looked at some of the major recent controversies, the Firestone tire litigation generated over 100 class actions. The Vioxx controversy, which is pending, most of which is pre-CAFA, has generated over 200 class actions. And these weren't separate lawsuits. These were, by and large, overlapping lawsuits where you had attorneys, each of them saying, I want to represent all of these folks, but I want to do it in a different court. And so you had a lot of redundancy of litigation, and no way when they were in state courts to bring those cases together or coordinate them in any way. I think a third concern, if you look through the legislative history, was a worry that the county courts that were getting a lot of these cases were not recognizing variations in state law on various subjects. There was a tendency in a lot of the class certification decisions to homogenize state law or simply say, I'm sitting in Illinois, I've got all the Illinois books, we'll just apply Illinois law to all the claims in this case coming in from all 50 states. And I think there was a concern that as a result, as a result of this, sort of an anti-federalism situation rapidly developing here, where basically the law of the land was being generated by several of the magnet state courts that were drawing a lot of these cases. And I think the last concern was, the major concern, if you look through the legislative history, was with the issue that John mentioned earlier, in that it was what were viewed as anti-consumer settlements. I think, really, if you look at the original framers of the legislation, they were genuinely motivated by the mail they were getting from their constituents saying, I'm getting these settlements in the mail for classes, and they tell me I had some kind of claim, but as far as I can tell, I'm not getting anything in this settlement, and it appears to me that the lawyers who are litigating this are getting lots of money, and I don't understand why this is happening. And there was a lot of that mail coming in, and if you think about it, for most citizens, this was the biggest contact with the legal system they had, was sitting at home going to their mailbox and getting this notice out that says, you filed a lawsuit, even though you may not have known it, and it's been settled, and you don't get anything. And I think there was a feeling of concern about that, particularly in the consumer class action arena. The approach that Congress took to this had several parts, and I think the main part that everybody's aware of was to expand federal jurisdiction over class actions. The feeling being that would take care of the magnet state court problem, because in the federal system it's much harder to file a case and have a strategy that successfully gets that case to a particular judge within a district, and so it is more of a random selection process. With respect to copycat class actions, I think Congress concluded that the idea of having more cases in federal court solved that problem, because with the multi-district panel, judicial panel on multi-district litigation there, if multiple class actions were filed either in federal or state court and then could be removed to federal court if they weren't filed there initially, the MDL panel would be able to draw those cases together as appropriate before a single judge and therefore have a coordinated resolution of those cases, and of course probably discouraging people from filing so many cases in the first place, because there's no point in doing that if they're all going to end up before the same judge anyway. I think there was a feeling that the federal courts were more respectful of other states' laws, that the precedents that were out there indicated greater concern with making sure that the appropriate state law was applied to each claim in a class action. And I think there was also a feeling that by moving cases to federal court, it would deal with this concern about anti-consumer settlements, as some members labeled the problem that the federal courts had been much more concerned about ensuring that settlements did provide benefits were appropriate to the class members, and had been much more ready to reject settlements along the way, noting in particular a number of instances where federal courts had rejected settlements and then they were taken to and approved by state courts. And so that's the way I think Congress is intending to address the problem. On that last point, there was the additional element of the bill, the provisions of the bill that were intended to protect consumer rights. I think if you look at the legislative history, the feeling was that those probably weren't necessary provisions in the federal courts, but were a way to ensure that the federal courts, who would then be dealing with a larger number of settlements, would be doing so properly. Let me just note a couple of quick things. I think my own view is that it's a little too early to see all of the impacts of this legislation, even after 2 years, particularly in the settlement arena, because the life of a class action before you get to resolution often takes longer than that. But I would note with respect to the magnet state court element of this that there was released in September of last year a study by several folks at the Federal Judicial Center looking at this issue who concluded that there was a movement of cases from state court to federal court. The state court data are hard to come by, but there definitely has been an increase in cases in federal courts. And I think if you talk to a lot of corporations, they will say that that's what they've observed as well, that the numbers of class actions are down somewhat, but the most marked change is that when they are filed, they are more readily filed in federal court. And a lot of counsel are just going there and filing them directly. You're not doing a lot of removal battles. The other thing I would note is that to the extent available, the data from the magnet state courts indicate that they are more or less out of business. The headline that has most caught my eye was in a September 2006 edition of Chicago Business that had the headline, "Judicial Hellhole Freezes Over." and the article basically reported that in Madison County, the numbers of class actions filed there have plummeted. And if you look at what is getting filed, the cases are more of a local nature, what you'd expect to see filed in a local state court. But I think that to the extent data are available, they're indicating that at least on the magnet state court issue, the act has definitely had some pretty immediate impact. I think on some of the other categories, it may take longer for those data to develop to allow firm conclusions in that regard.
Thank you very much, John.
Our next speaker is John Stoya. John is a founding partner of LaRocque, Coughlin, Stoya, Geller, Rudman, and Robbins, and he's resident in the San Diego office. John has extensive experience in class action litigation, especially in the securities and insurance areas, and he is a frequent speaker and lecturer on both class action issues and the Class Action Fairness Act. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I'm John Stoya. One of my partners emailed me last night and said he fell over in his office when he saw the announcement on the web that I was going to be speaking before the Federal Society. He said he couldn't decide whether it was like being a nun in a brothel or a whore in a nun house. So I told him that I wasn't going to pass an opinion one way or the other. But he did ask that I get some sort of autographed portrait or otherwise. That's fear. I know what I was telling John as I sat down. I didn't really think I'd see my name on the card like that, but he said if I just put John Story versus the Federal Society, it would make me feel more comfortable. So I'm going to do that after I get to the staging, and hopefully I'll feel a little bit more comfortable. Anyway, thank you for having me. As John said, CAF has been on the books for 2 years now, and there are certain trends I believe as a class action practitioner that are really apparent, that I do not think are going to be reversed. One is the number of state court class actions has dropped off dramatically. We being my firm, do not file that many state court class actions anyway. We prefer to be in federal court for a multitude of reasons. But from our standpoint, we're not happy now that we're seeing a lot more class actions that were either removed right after CAFA was passed, or more importantly, those cases are being filed there in the first instance by state court practitioners. Two, I think that a lot of attorneys on the plaintiff side who practice in state court, involved state court class actions in their home jurisdictions, are not filing them anymore. Many of them, are fearful of going to federal court, but they don't have quite the comfort level that they had before their local state court judge than they do with a federal judge with a lifetime appointment with three law clerks, as John said, could actually read a lot of the various legal provisions and apply them to the proposed class that was being certified. Again, assuming that the class was actually certified after the complaint was filed. I was aware of one case down in what used to be known as one of the judicial hellholes of Alabama where the actual certification, the lawyer filed the complaint and then he filed the certification with it, and the certification got signed, but the complaint never got filed. But as they say, John, the good days are over. But after the second anniversary now, one of the things I said is that the number of filings has decreased dramatically in state court. The other thing that we've noticed is that this is taxing the federal courts, as we predicted. Many of the federal judiciaries and districts around the court are missing 4, 5, 6, 7 judges, and now they are having a much, much more difficult time dealing with the influx of these class actions. Again, recently I had a case where the judge told me when I was asking for a trial date, told me that he ought to strike my jury demand, and then he kind of half-kiddingly said also I ought to strike my trial demand because it was going to be 4 to 5 years before a case was going to be heard on his docket at the current pace. Which is not, that is not fair to either the plaintiffs or the defendants, because that means that case is going to drag on for quite some time. There's no way we can move it to another district. There's really nothing we can do. We're stuck with what we have. Let me just talk, if I can, briefly about what the big issues have been with the statute since it was passed and it was rushed through in February 2005. The comments I'm about to make about the statute are by no means directed at John. I'm going to allege the statute or criticize it for being poorly drafted. John, although being one of the principal drafters of the statute, had an opportunity to get that thing passed in February of 2005, and they did what they had to do. There's a lot of provisions in that statute during the last week in which it was getting passed that were getting modified. Some were being deleted. Some were being added. And what ended up happening with the statute is having certain provisions in there that make no sense, or it's left now to the courts to figure out what they mean. Let me go through a couple of the simple ones, and then we'll go to the more difficult ones. Right after the act was passed, one of the issues was, what was commencement? When was the law effective? The statute says at the very end of the act, it says that this only applies to actions commenced on or after February 18th, 2005. Well, the defense bar, being as creative as they are, started removing every case that was filed, not every case, but 90% of them, that was filed prior to CAFA, alleging that when they removed it, it was now being commenced in federal court. That even though it was filed prior to February 18th, 2005, once it was removed, it was now commenced in federal court. That got shot down fairly quickly. Most of the courts did not buy that reasoning, but I will give it to the defense bar for creative lawyering. The other issues that came up, though, were a little more difficult, and that is, what happens if you had a pre-CAFA case that was then amended somehow, adding new parties, adding new claims, extending the class period, changing the theory of the case to conform to the discovery, or whatever the case may be? And in that regard, the courts are all over the board. We've seen decisions within the same district on the same subject with three different opinions coming from various courts. But basically, the courts have held that if there's a change in the class definition or you're adding new defendants to a complaint or doing something like that, adding a new claim, if it relates back on what is called the relation back doctrine under 15C,
In other words, if you had amended your original complaint and added that claim, would it relate back to the original filing date? If that standard fits, then it's not seen as a new commencement of the action, and the old one stays in state court. But one of the things that's changed, that's been very interesting about CAFA is if a case is removed from state court to federal court under CAFA, whether it's a pre-CAFA case filed before the enactment or even post, if it's removed, is who has the burden for remanding the case. In other words, if a defendant removes the case to federal court, and that's who has the option to remove it, not the plaintiffs, obviously, if they remove a case from state court to federal court, who has the burden of proof to show that there's federal jurisdiction and that the federal court should hear it? The law had always been that that burden was up to the party seeking removal and seeking to invoke the federal jurisdiction. Well, now with CAFA, that has changed, and now the courts, again, are split as to who has the burden of proof. Some courts, in contradiction to the traditional law, have held that the burden of proof is now on the plaintiff, although nowhere in the statute does it say that the burden has shifted to the party that's seeking to remand the case back to state court. Other states like Oklahoma and Mississippi and Pennsylvania have said that, no, the traditional rule still applies, and the burden is on the person seeking to invoke federal jurisdiction. Those issues are still kind of percolating their way through the courts. I'm not aware of any appeals on any of those issues recently. I think the federal courts are dealing with them as best that they can. But one of the points that John made earlier, which is now I think has changed the landscape, is that if somebody's going to file a class action now, unless you're in a big state like California or Texas or New York or somewhere where you have enough aggregate class members to make the case worthwhile, people just file them in federal court now. So you don't have any issues on removability and remand and related issues. Now, there's also another provision that has going around, but the courts, again, dealt with it fairly quickly, and that dealt with the issue of appealing a denial or a grant of a remand. And the statute said that any appeal of a denial or grant of a remand had to be not less than 7 days, and which just made no sense, that you couldn't file your petition unless 7 days had passed, but it wouldn't make sense as to, well, can you wait a year? Can you wait 5 years or whatever? Some courts just kind of ignored it, didn't realize it just like it wasn't there. The best court that I saw that handled it said it was just a typo, and it should have said not more than 7 days. And it just was a typo, less, more, whatever. Let's just put it right in and read it, which makes the most sense. Now, another issue that has come up is the issue about appeals. And it's a very interesting provision. It says, if the appeal is filed, then the Court of Appeals, has 60 days in which to decide the petition. And that within that 60 days, if they don't decide the petition, and it's since the date of filing, not briefing, nothing, from the date of filing, they have 60 days to decide it. If they don't decide it, then it's deemed denied, whether it's a remand, in favor of remand or denial of a remand. Then it has a provision that says that you can get one 10-day extension for good cause, but it doesn't say who's supposed to give that, who's supposed to ask for that extension. Does the court ask for the extension and grant themselves 10 days, or what are they supposed to do? Then there's another provision, and it says that the parties can agree to an indefinite extension for as long as they like on how much time it takes for the Court of Appeals to rule. Now, that seems fairly nice that, you know, the parties get together and say, we don't want to put any burden on the Court of Appeals, so you guys just take all the time you want on deciding that remand or the denial of a remand, and you get back to us in the district court. Now, if John's provision that he had in there about staying of discovery till that was decided, that would have been a much bigger issue. But now, since that provision got pulled at the last minute, it's not that large of an issue, except that it makes no sense. If you won the remand and somebody took you up on appeal, you would never agree to extend that 60 days, because as soon as that petition is filed, the Court of Appeals has 60 days to decide. Same thing is true if you're on the defense side. If you removed and the court denied the remand, you'd never agree to an extension, because you want to put the time pressure on the Court of Appeals. Now, the last kind of issue that's out there is this issue of a coupon settlement. I have not, and John alluded to this earlier, I have not seen many coupon settlements in a long time. I think by the time that the statute was passed, coupon settlements had decreased substantially. I have some faith in state courts and more faith in federal courts. They have dealt with the issue of coupon settlements. You had the Fleet Boston case and some other very kind of egregious ones that were out there that became the poster child. But coupon settlements more and more are very rare, and you don't see them on either side of the bar. What's ironic about it is many times it was the defendants who were always advocating the coupon settlement, not the plaintiff's lawyers, and now since coupon settlements are tied directly to fees and otherwise, you're not going to see them, I don't suspect, only in rare circumstances. Now, I do, like I said, I do enjoy litigating against the defendants and their counsel, some of which are very creative. I had a case recently where a defendant removed me to federal court on a state court case that was an individual action. It was one plaintiff versus one defendant. But the basis of removal and the petition, you got to love this, this basis of removal, and it's somebody who lectures on CAFA quite frequently, removed me on the grounds that in my complaint I had used the word them when referring to a statute instead of using a singular verb. And so I'd used them instead of her when it was a female plaintiff. And then he went on to say that if you look at my website and you look at my background, I don't do individual actions. I do class actions. So this is going to be a class action someday. So let's just cut through the BS and get this thing into federal court. And I called up a defense lawyer, and he said, I just felt like it was time to call a spade a spade. And I said, well, just so you know, I'm not going to amend that case. I'm going to keep it there forever as an individual action, even if I wanted it to be a federal action, just to spite you. So anyway, they are creative. But in summary, and I know I got to wrap up a little bit quickly. CAFA, in our opinion, in my opinion, the Republicans got what they paid for. Big business got what they paid for. Everything is now into federal court. You have the backlog now sitting in federal court with these actions. I think that many of the myths that were behind the passage of the act, like the so-called judicial hellholes, were things that were just a response that were really unnecessary. For example, and John again alluded to this when I think you started doing CAFA, they were responding to the problem in Alabama of drive-by certifications. Well, the Alabama citizens and constituents took care of that and now has a very, very conservative Supreme Court, and I'm not aware of any class actions being filed in a state court in Alabama anymore. Then the same thing happened in Mississippi. That was also one of the judicial hellholes. But the same thing happened there in Mississippi. They passed legislation and they changed their Supreme Court, and you cannot get cases certified in Mississippi State Court under what used to be known as the aggregation rule. Same is true for Texas. And inevitably, the famous judicial hellhole of Madison County that John talked about, where President Bush went to go sign the legislation with all the doctors standing behind him and all that, even though doctors typically aren't sued in class actions, Madison County was kind of next in line to be dealt with. The Illinois Supreme Court had shifted dramatically. It's now a very conservative state court, and as you saw with the Avery decision, which came out of the Southern District or Madison County, that was ultimately overturned by the Illinois Supreme Court. So with that, then one last thing I will respond, just one last second if I could, John. That's the report that John Bison referred to. There is a study that was done from the time period, I think, 2001 to like June 2005, that was done by the counsel that John identified. It does show much more filings in federal court by both removal and in the first instance. There's supposed to be an interim report coming out sometime this spring, and I think that report will confirm that you'll see very few removals and that all cases are being filed in federal court in the first instance. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for those remarks, John. Our next speaker is Michael Housebell. Michael is a partner, a named partner at Cohen Milstein Housebell & Toll. Like our other panelists, he has extensive experience with class action litigation, and in particular, he's been involved in such high-profile matters as representing victims of the Holocaust and representing victims of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Judge Edward Corman of the Eastern District of New York has described Michael as one of the top two class action lawyers in the United States, and the New York Times has called him one of the nation's most prominent antitrust lawyers. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much, John. And as usual, I'm honored to speak to the Federalist Society. I was a little skeptical that it was Valentine's Day, but I thought I would take my chances anyway. One thing I'd like to start with is the fact that the Class Action Fairness Act does not cover just one type of claim. And I think we have to look at the Act in terms of the different offenses which may invoke its provisions. There are mass torts, there are securities violations, there are competition or antitrust cases, and each one presents different issues which I don't think have as yet been resolved or litigated fully at the federal level, issues that we're all going to have to live with to determine how best to deal with now that the cases, for the most part, in all three areas at a minimum, are in a federal court as opposed to a state court. Let me give you some practical examples. In the antitrust arena, there were state, what they call Illinois brick repealer states, as well as your federal direct claims. So you could have a claimant on behalf of a direct purchaser who had a claim under the Sherman Act, and then an indirect purchaser or a consumer who had a claim under state law. Now, before, both cases were filed in different jurisdictions, one federal, one state. Now they're both consolidated in federal court. But they're consolidated in federal court at one aggregation of all the federal cases, and then, let's say, 27 aggregations of state cases. Well, there are procedures in order to select a lead counsel for the federal case. What procedures are in place to select a lead counsel in the state cases? Since we're still operating under a lexicon rule, all of the state cases, for the most part, get sent back to their respective federal courts in that state. Can one counsel really be selected to lead the state claims of all state cases involving competition law in a federal court? And if not, how as well then do you coordinate discovery between the federal direct case and all the state cases? And do the state rules of procedure, which otherwise would have prevailed prior to removal, determine the rights of the state cases in federal court? What difference does it make? Well, many states have different rules of procedure with regard to attorney work product privilege, or scope of discovery. Does the discovery, in essence, in now these combined cases, get influenced by the most permissive rules of procedure in a state court? Because if you've got a state counsel in one jurisdiction who says, well, my state permits me to get this much discovery, and if that much discovery is permitted for him, does the discovery in the remainder of the case have to follow the most permissive? Since how can you explain why a federal claimant would only get more limited discovery, whereas a state claimant would get a more expansive discovery? And how would you explain the difference between one state claimant and any other state claimant if you're all in the same court? So there are a lot more problems than there are solutions, and the courts are just now getting used to them. How do you combine, unless there is a settlement, all of the cases moving forward, if you have different laws and then as well different provisions within those laws which require different proofs? And what do you do with regard to an attempt at a settlement? Before you could get all federal claims resolved possibly at one time. But now the defendants come in and say, well, gee, we would like to resolve everything because there's just one bucket of money. Well, for those of you who practice, at the state level, you notice that there's a different group of egos involved in the, indirect cases than there are in the direct cases. And it's your direct plaintiffs who are saying, well, we have the injury. but under Illinois BRIC, no one can claim that the injury is passed on. But in the very same piece of litigation, you have the indirect claimant saying, well, gee whiz, everything was passed down to us, so we're entitled to everything. What do you do as a judge? How do you relate to that? How do you resolve the discovery disputes where the federal plaintiffs are saying, we're not giving you this information with regard to the state claimants, and the state claimants insisting that they can get the discovery from the federal claimants because they want to show that that whatever was overcharged was in fact passed on. Those are issues that have not yet been resolved, and those are issues that are being faced, and they get further complicated because one of the reasons behind the consolidation of the federal and state cases where there is at least an overlap is now being overburdened or being overviewed or overlaid, really, by foreign claims of a similar nature. And we see this particularly in the mass tort arena, where you have foreign claimants, I think John mentioned, the Firestone case, coming in and wanting to have their claims heard in federal court as well, or previously filing them in state court that are now removed to federal court. So now you have federal claims, you have state claims, and you have foreign claims. And I'm not sure whether this has made the process of pretrial simpler, more expedient, or actually more difficult because of the differences in one court with dealing with different interests. One of the interesting things that has been mentioned is the coupon settlement. And clearly, as John Stoyer said, that the coupon settlement, almost by its own evolution, was going out of vogue by the time the Fairness Act came into place. But clearly, with regard to coupon settlements, business shares the shame, because it was in business's interest many times to at least entice a coupon settlement as opposed to a cash settlement because it was less expensive. In the Microsoft litigation, for example, a settlement was presented in federal court that would have provided $1 billion in cash. The judge rejected it because it wasn't enough. It went to state settlements. In the state settlements, there were coupons. The coupon rate of return was less than 7%. Who paid? Business found it was more useful to go to coupons, and the federal court rejected the cash. The issue of the coupon settlement was one I don't think that can be laid necessarily wholly at the foot of the plaintiff's counsel. I think it's one that has to be looked at both from the perspective of CAFA and the class actions and what makes the most sense and what the court is going to approve. And if there are going to be problems with those settlements, the blame is going to have to be shared because there is a conflict of interest. Finally, one of the issues that have been raised or asked to be raised is, has CAFA restored fairness to the class action mechanism? I'm not sure that the mechanism ever lost fairness. Magic jurisdictions or magnet jurisdictions may have tipped the scales in favor of an abuse of the mechanism, but the mechanism essentially remains judicially sound. There needs to be some form of aggregation of claims where you have at least masses of individuals who claim to be similarly situated and injured by a common course of conduct. If you don't, what's the alternative? Now, some courts or some businesses would like to say, well, individual cases, try it individually. Well, that works well for the business if you have a million people injured, and it doesn't work well if you're the millionth person who is injured. Because unlike the West Virginia lottery, where they tell you, for example, that you've won $1 million and that's a dollar a year for the next million years, you don't want to be that millionth person because you're not going to get any justice. So what do you do in a modern society where you do have to face the reality that there are mass wrongs? What kind of mechanism is the judicial system going to make available to provide access for redress of those without clogging the system or really injuring further the victims? Are there problems with regard to the act that can be resolved by further legislation? Please no. No more. Let's deal with what we have and let's work it out. But I don't think this is the time to make any further amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And our next and final panelist is Ted Frank. Ted is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he's also the director of the AEI Liability Project. Ted's research and scholarship focuses on a number of areas, including product liability, class actions, and corporate regulation. Before joining AEI in 2005, Ted was a litigator in private practice, and he worked on such notable cases as defending the 2003 California gubernatorial recall election against an ACLU challenge. So, different organization. Anyways, Ted. Take it away.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank the Federalist Society and Dean for inviting me here today, and thank all of you for braving the wintry mix on a Valentine's Day for the romantic topic of federal jurisdiction and class actions. Normally, the closing act is the biggest name on the panel, and that clearly isn't the case today, where I'm maybe the second biggest name not named John. So I apologize for that in advance. Start off by saying that Michael and I apparently agree on a lot, surprisingly. We agree that there should be an aggregation mechanism for small claims, and the issue is abuse of that mechanism rather than the mechanism itself. We agree that the coupon settlements, the problems regarding coupon settlements can be laid equally at the hands of the defense bar and the sort of conspiring to screw over the individual class members. But though I would disagree that the coupons were disappearing, we're still seeing them today. We saw that with the Netflix settlement in California that the FTC intervened in to improve that for class members, and we've seen it. We're still seeing coupon settlements in a lot of state court cases pending from pre-CAFA days. I think we even agree that the Illinois BRIC case presents real problems for the aggregation of class actions for direct and indirect purchasers, but that sort of overlapping problem, I think, predated CAFA and postdates it until antitrust law reconciles there. CAFA has had real positive effects in terms of state court magnet jurisdictions overlapping class actions and the problem of upside-down federalism that John Beisner identified. But the main issue I wish to raise today is that we need to be very careful in evaluating the degree to which CAFA solves the problem of abusive class actions, because the environment is still in transitional flux. The American litigation system is a shining beacon to the principle that incentives work. The possibility of billions of dollars of attorney's fees provides gigantic incentives for creative entrepreneurial lawyering to effectuate such wealth transfers. And the degree to which CAFA eventually succeeds in cabining abusive class actions is going to depend on the success of the response of by the plaintiff's bar to CAFA and the degree to which all three branches of government counter respond. I have 4 points today. First, the effectiveness of CAFA will be difficult to measure because changing strategies mean that old metrics no longer provide accurate comparisons for what is going on in the courtrooms. Second, federal courts and, if necessary, Congress will need to react effectively to the efforts of the plaintiff's bar to transport pre-CAFA state court tactics to the post-CAFA federal court environment. Third, those that are interested in civil justice need to be wary of academic efforts that seek to eliminate limits on class actions and aggregate litigation and the effect that those efforts might have on the rights of unnamed class members and defendants. And finally, that even if CAFA fully succeeds, there remains work to be done, because in a post-Erie world, There's still problems from substantive state laws that are conducive to class action abuse, and CAFA merely shifts the forum for such problems to federal courts without the power to correct them. There is an inherent difficulty in attempting to measure how much effect the Class Action Fairness Act has had, because it was not passed in a vacuum, and lawyers who acted one way before CAFA find new ways to maximize the results after it. You've already heard that the most litigated word in CAFA is the word commence, and that's because CAFA only applies to class actions that are commenced after the date of its passage, and there were a lot of class actions filed on February 17th. Trial lawyers have, just as the defense bar has been removing class actions willy-nilly, the trial bar has been amending older class actions to try to evade the CAFA provisions. Instead of filing new class actions, they're amending old ones to add new claims and sometimes even new plaintiffs and defendants. Sometimes the federal courts hold that these amended complaints have a transformative effect that commence a new action. Other times they say that commence is narrowly read to apply only to amended claims that cannot be related back to the original filing of the complaint. This latter reading isn't an unreasonable reading of the text of the statute, other than the fact that it contradicts a tremendous amount of precedent how federal courts interpret the phrase commence in federal jurisdictional statutes. It's not widely known, but in the vast majority of cases before CAFA, when Congress amended the jurisdictional rules, courts interpreted commence with a bright line rule that commenced in federal courts was commenced with removal. Those statutes tended to shrink jurisdiction rather than expand it, which might be why the courts have changed that. But I think the problems that we're seeing today over what commence means is because courts no longer adopt that bright line rule in reading the word commence, and Congress didn't anticipate the change in meaning from what had been done in previous statutes. But the change in tactics has two effects important to our discussion today, which is first, one can't simply look at the number of new filings to measure class action activity. Once upon a time, you start a new class action by making a new filing. Others would file overlapping and redundant class actions that inflated the numbers without actually changing the total amount of litigation out there. Now plaintiffs are amending old class actions, or they're making do with the one class action that's in federal court. Counting filings is no longer a good proxy for the level of litigation to the extent it ever was. And any statistical study that fails to account for this is going to have a garbage in, garbage out problem. And we need to be wary of that as data comes out. And because of this, it's going to remain unclear a couple of years out, and will remain unclear for some time, what the long-term effect on class action litigation is going to be. There were hundreds of nationwide class actions pending in Madison County alone when CAFA was passed, thousands nationwide. And while it's apparently the case that no one is commencing new nationwide classes, there's no telling how many of these old classes are sort of serving as sourdough starters for new class actions. And until that pig works its way through the python, the impact of CAFA is going to be dampened. We're not going to see what the real effect has been. It has had an effect. Plaintiffs always have the options of amending class actions complaints before CAFA, so the fact that they're doing it now and didn't do it before shows that they view this as an inferior option at the margin, but you can't simply look at the fact that they're not filing new class actions in Madison County and assume that the problem's completely gone. There's forum shopping in federal court, for example. Litigation tactics are dynamic rather than static, and just as we can now expect defense counsel to always make a Section 1453 appeal of a remand order, we can expect plaintiff's counsel to use tactics in federal court that they previously used in state court. Federal courts don't quite create the same opportunities for magnet jurisdictions that state courts in Madison County did, but the opportunities are still there. As Judge Cabrera said in a Second Circuit argument, I can't help but wonder how and why these cases involving so-called aggregation of claims invariably are assigned to Judge Weinstein. And none of the named plaintiffs and none of the defendants in the Schwab Light Cigarettes class action resided in the Eastern District of New York. And Michael can explain how and why, but it was filed there. It ended up in Judge Weinstein's courtroom, and he certified a gigantic nationwide class.
An opinion.
In a lengthy opinion. So we can that's a very small magnet jurisdiction, and it's subject to life tenure. But it's a magnet that will grow even stronger if the Second Circuit doesn't take a stand on defending Rule 23's class certification standards. We're also, I think, going to start seeing, I don't mean to keep picking on your cases, Michael, but a magnet jurisdiction in the Ninth Circuit where the courts have signed off on class certifications of employment litigation. I'm referring here, of course, to Dukes v. Walmart. Time doesn't permit a full analysis of Judge Pregerson's opinion. I do recommend Judge Kleinfeld's dissent and pointing out the interesting issue of how $500 billion in compensatory and punitive damages does not predominate the declaratory and injunctive relief being sought. And you can wonder whether the substantive dog is being wagged by the procedural tail. But the fact that Dukes was certified, if that ends up getting upheld by the en banc or by the Supreme Court, I think we can see billions and billions of dollars of other similar class actions being filed in the Ninth Circuit, courts. We're already seeing Costco had a very similar class action certified there. That's a potential problem in the future. The third point I want to raise is that of academic efforts. The American Law Institute, which used to be satisfied with restatements of the law, propounded in September its preliminary draft number 4 of the Principles of Law of Aggregate Litigation, which openly acknowledges itself as a conscious break from class action precedent with the object of, quote, maximizing the net value, unquote, of class claims through such mechanisms as single-issue class certification, or even holding defendants liable for ethical breaches by plaintiffs' class counsel. This is not the place for a full critique of the problems in the ALI principles, but all those interested in civil justice need to pay attention to what eventually comes out of ALI on that subject, because there's little doubt that it will move precedence when this influential organization speaks. Finally, one might not know it to read the press releases of lobbyists who opposed CAFA, but outside of settlement approval, CAFA did not change substantive law, just procedure. This means that the substantive state law that led to some abusive class actions remains a problem. Consumer protection lawsuits have strayed from their original purpose of protecting consumers, and many quote-unquote consumer fraud laws have become vehicles for trial lawyers and special interest groups to bring lawsuits alleging purely hypothetical injury for the benefit of those who bring the lawsuit at the expense of consumers and the democratic process. Again, a full discussion is beyond the scope of my time here today, but much work remains to be done at the state level to fix those problems and restore consumer fraud laws to the focus of protecting consumers who reasonably rely upon an act or practice declared unlawful and suffer a monetary property loss. And I think the success of Prop 64 in California shows that reform in this area is not just good policy, but good politics, and will do much in the class action field in that area. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for those remarks, Ted. And now I'd like to throw the floor open to questions. Our panelists have agreed to submit to Q&A. But before I do that, I do have one question of my own that I want to begin with. This is for all the panelists. And I guess, like Ted, I was a little bit surprised by the amount of agreement I heard during the discussion, and on two key points. One was about the effect that CAFA has had on the magnet jurisdictions, and second, about the effect that it has had on the coupon settlements. And in both of these areas, I guess I'm scratching my head and wondering, is it fair to say that CAFA has been a success? That seems like a surprising result, and not one that we're used to here in Washington. Is that an accurate assessment, or are there still flaws in those areas that are waiting to be addressed? It sounded like there was a little bit of a whiff of dissent from Ted in that he mentioned that some federal jurisdictions, or at least individual judges, are becoming their own variety of the magnet jurisdiction. But other than that, I didn't really hear much in the way of concern about those issues. Have those issues been completely addressed, or are there problems that we should still expect to arise?
Well, in terms of the state magnet jurisdictions, I think the answer at this point seems to be yes. You know, even if you get the case started there, defendants are removing them to federal court. They're getting, if there are multiple or redundant classes, they're getting removed immediately to the panel. Once they get to the panel, they're getting transferred to a singular district. And it's fairly too new to see what's happened with those districts, but I think those transferee courts are going to be reluctant to send those cases back to federal court or state court in the states that they originated. With regard to the coupon settlements, I don't think CAFA had anything to do with it. I think it was a natural evolution that the public had become absolutely opposed to the coupon settlement, despite businesses' interest and the interest of some lawyers on the plaintiff's side in the coupon settlement. It's not the quality of the settlement, I think, that changed that. It was the quality of the lawyers and the types of cases that gave rise to the coupon settlement. And this, as well, I think, spills into the whole area of Cypre, where you have consumer frauds, you know, kind of like the Yellow Cab case, which may really take small amounts of money from large amounts of people. Maybe the mechanism of a class is appropriate to restitute the amount that was illegally taken, but maybe at that point you need to decide another means of distribution other than checks to individuals or coupons for small amounts of money.
One point I think I'd offer on the settlement issue is I do think CAFA has had a pretty significant impact there. I think Michael is right that coupon settlements had come under significant fire before the statute was enacted, and I think it's in part because there was a lot of discussion about it being generated by the legislation when it was being considered. But if you look at both the Senate and the House reports on the bill that had a substantial catalog of settlements that were worrisome to the proponents of the bill, those settlements, the Senate report has settlements, coupon settlements, right up to the date of enactment. They were continuing. I think the pace had slowed somewhat, but they were continuing to that point. And if you look at where those settlements were happening, the courts that were approving those settlements were, by and large, the magnet state courts. And what was happening in those cases, I think, I disagree somewhat on the notion that, you got to look at both sides, and this is a conspiracy between plaintiffs and defendants. I'm not denying it can't happen in some cases, but I think what typically was happening in these cases was that the plaintiffs were going to the defendants and saying, look, we're in Madison County. This is a no-win proposition. We'll make this over early, pay us, and we're not looking for much on the side of this for the plaintiffs in this case, but if we get, what we're looking for as far as our profit margin out of this case, we'll be gone. And if you look at case after case, a lot of them weren't even coupon settlements. They were just flat out agreement to some injunctive relief that was already in place anyway, and we'll have to pay $26 million or something on the side. But there was a very high correlation between the magnet courts approving those and those settlements. I mean, I think the fact that those courts are now, although there's a lot of inventory to be run down, are out of the picture, indicates that those sorts of settlements will be less frequent in the future.
Well, let me just say a couple of words. I agree with Michael about the magnet jurisdictions. I do believe that CAFA has pretty much eliminated those magnet jurisdictions. And even those people who would file a state court case there, get it removed to federal and then get sent to another district. I also agree with Michael. I doubt that any transferee judge is going to send that case back to one of those districts. But, again, on the issue of coupon settlements, we love to use that as the poster child, as I would like to say, and differing with John, it takes two to tango. I've been in many, many settlement conferences where the defendants have tried to offer up some form of coupon or otherwise, and we flatly refuse. Our firm refuses to do them, and I refuse to do them. But, everyone says, coupon settlement. They think, well, you got to buy something to get anything back, and it only benefits the defendants and only benefits the plaintiff's lawyers. But remember that, you know, coupon settlements, there's actually quite a few of them out there that were pretty good. We had a case, and I don't remember if Michael Hausfeld was in it with us, but it was a case against Mercedes dealing with defective tires that people were putting on their cars. And we sent out $150 million worth of coupons to the class members, and the coupons were good for $1,000 cash. And since Mercedes did not want to send out $1,000 checks to everybody, if you took it down to the dealership, one special purpose was there, they're not to sell you, they give you a check from Mercedes for $1,000. So that was actually a pretty good coupon that you could take to your bank and cash it. But on the issue of whether or not CAFA is responsible for it, I think that the industry was, the plaintiff's bar was policing itself. I believe Ted mentioned the Netflix settlement. That settlement did not go over well with anybody. Not only did Ted's organization get involved, but also, for example, the trial lawyers for public justice filed briefs trying to keep that case from being approved and having it amended and later fixed. The old saying about victory has a thousand fathers, I've seen since the Netflix settlement was disapproved and then resubmitted with far more substance, I think everybody that filed some form of objection in that case has taken credit for fixing it. So I don't necessarily know who's...
I take no credit.
You take no credit for that.
Well,
okay.
I was at the FTC when we filed that brief, and we definitely took credit.
Did you take credit for that? Well, TLPJ and everyone else did.
Right.
But the reality being that those things come up. The public doesn't like them. People don't do them, and they get dealt with fairly quickly.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the floor? Looks like we do.
I have a question about certification of CAFA class actions. My impression was that it was very hard to certify in federal court a nationwide class action premised on state law because you have 50 different jurisdictions' laws. It was hard to show predominance of common issues in that circumstance. And so what I wondered was whether CAFA would result in a situation where a nationwide state law class actions were removed to federal court but then decertified there. And so I wondered whether CAFA would lead to a situation where we pretty much put an end to nationwide class actions based on state law. And I'm just curious, what has been the certification outcomes of these state law nationwide class actions?
Well, I think that in the federal courts had pretty much decided that in many circumstances that nationwide classes couldn't be adopted. There's certainly some exceptions to that, and if counsel were able to show that you group the state laws in certain ways in order to achieve certification through subclasses, you could do it. They're certainly not unprecedented. But I haven't seen much change in that attitude among the federal courts. The appellate courts are pretty much locked into that that position previously, and I think that the federal courts have held by that view. I think you're seeing among counsel proposing classes certainly more creativity in looking at the cases that say, see if there are a way to group the classes to achieve a certification through the use of subclasses of states with similar laws and things of that sort. But I don't think that there's been a major change of that. And, of course, we've had some of the states that have joined the chorus as well, you know, New York, Illinois, and Texas in fairly rapid succession saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, in our own choice of law principles, we're not going to embrace this notion of applying other states or our laws to other states because we don't want other states to be doing that to our consumers. So I think there's a, you know, a growing consensus that you need to respect the laws on that, the individual state laws, and not try to homogenize those in a way just to facilitate class certification.
And the issue, to some extent, is it really beneficial or detrimental? I separate the issue of federal claim, you know, and state claims, where you have a state, let's say, tort claim for fraud. And as John said, you know, both the state courts and the federal courts, for the most part, have rejected the nationalization of fraud-type claims unless there is, you know, total overlap, except in those jurisdictions where you can claim that the company would be responsible in its home state and therefore the home state law should apply throughout the entire nation. But no one's ever taken any of those cases to trial. So what happens if you have 50 separate state cases involving fraud of a single company with a common course of conduct. You've got 50 classes? Do you have 50 sets of instructions? Do you have 50, you know, special questions? Or do you send it back to the, you know, to each of the 50 jurisdictions? What's gained? Nobody knows because no one's ever followed it through. So I haven't done an economic balance of whether it makes more sense or less sense if you can. And many times we've approached defendants with this. Doesn't it make more sense to bind everyone and get one determination, or do you really want 50 determinations, which on balance, suppose the plaintiffs win 10, you know, and let's say lose 40, but the 10 that they win far outweigh the 40 that they lost.
I think we have a question at the back.
I have a question, Mr. Frank. You talked about the consumer protection laws at the state level, and I was wondering if you could give us some examples of consumers alleging purely hypothetical injury and winning those cases.
Well, winning is different than being able to force a settlement. For example, the Toshiba settlement in Texas over some problem with the computer chips that didn't affect any consumers. The vast majority of consumers wouldn't even notice the problem. The rest could have it fixed by Toshiba, but that ended up settling for $2.1 billion. At AEI, Michael Grieva has written a book called Harmless Class Actions, a monograph called Harmless Class Actions that identifies many, many of these cases. The famous one, of course, until recently reversed by the Illinois Supreme Court, Price v. Philip Morris, a $10.1 billion trial court judgment over light cigarettes, alleging, again, consumer fraud over the sale of light cigarettes over the course of 20 years. Now, since the quote-unquote consumer fraud has been revealed, consumers haven't stopped purchasing light cigarettes. They haven't said, these light cigarettes are harmful. I didn't realize light cigarettes are harmful. I'm going to stop buying them. No, they're buying them as much as they always have. Yet the trial court found that 90% of sales were as a result of the fraud and therefore needed to be restituted, was the verb I heard earlier today. I mean, that sort of economic junk science resulted in a $10.1 billion award that almost bankrupted Philip Morris until the Illinois Supreme Court stepped in and said this was an inappropriate class action. But similar class actions are pending in Massachusetts, in Minnesota, in Missouri. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court now called Watson v. Philip Morris that's going to probably send a lot of these cases back to state court under the pre-CAFA regime. I think Michael wants to step in.
I'd like to respond to that because there's a perfect example of the focus or the shift to the class device as opposed to the substantive violation. If, in fact, there was a fraud in that the tobacco industry defrauded consumers into believing and purchasing light cigarettes because of the representation that they were less harmful, then that applies to everyone, or at least all of those who bought in the belief that the representation was true. So the class device is not what makes the action bad or good. The reality is that's what the marketing was directed at, and the marketing was directed at the tens of millions of people. Why shouldn't the judicial system have the means of assessing whether or not that marketing did what it intended to do and affected however many people? That's not junk science. It's junk marketing, but the issue is not in the mechanism to reach the substantive determination. It's in whether or not there was a fraud.
Yeah, I think I disagree with that point because I think it's really a combination of, and when you're talking about consumer protection statutes, a combination of the statutes themselves and the class action device that causes the problem.
think that Michael's correct that one of the issues that's out there with a lot of consumer protection statutes is that the states didn't do a clear enough job in distinguishing the authority that they were giving to their state attorneys general versus what they intended to put out there for a private right of action. They wanted to arm the attorneys general with the ability to say that advertisement is fraudulent and I'm going to file an injunctive relief action to stop you from putting that ad on television. And they failed to distinguish that sufficiently from a private cause of action where you're trying to recover damages because someone was injured. And so you have some statutes out there that, frankly, are not very clear about what is it if you are a private litigant and you claim you've been damaged, you additionally have to show beyond the fact that there was something wrong with the ad. In short, what's the causal nexus between the two? Most fraud cases, you've got to say, and I was interested the way Michael phrased that, I relied on it. I saw it and I relied on it when I bought those cigarettes. Well, the problem is a lot of those statutes said, no, you don't have to show reliance. You got to show a causal nexus. And then you get that fuzzed up, and what's happened with a lot of the class action cases is that the states have said, well, we favor class certification in these circumstances. We want consumer fraud to be enforced. And so you end up with classes that are certified where most of the class members didn't rely on anything, probably never saw it. But the states, in order to facilitate class certification in some instances, and I'm not saying all states, I think a lot of them have dealt with this properly, but some of them have said, you know, sort of said, you don't need an individual nexus. We'll just have some expert come in to say, well, most people would have bought if they'd seen that ad. And that's what fills the causal nexus. So I think it's really been a combination of the fact that the consumer protection statutes in many states, not all, but many, have not been well drafted to deal with the private right of action, and the use of the class device to sort of paper over the fact that a lot of the folks in the class aren't injured in any way.
But, John, if you're saying that the issue is not clear because the statute is unclear, then you can't you can't say definitively or absolutely that the class device is inappropriate to address a situation for which there is no clarity.
No, I think it's a combination of the two. Look, and let me give you a concrete example. If I bought this glass and it was an advertisement that it was unbreakable, okay, and I went into court and I said, well, I'm suing because I dropped this glass on the floor and I broke the glass. No court in its right mind would say, well, did you see the ad before you bought the glass? Was there some causation between the ad and buying the glass? Wouldn't do that. But in these class actions, you don't have to show in a lot of them. Because of the class device, they find ways because it's a class.
No, you're slipping now. You know, you're saying, you know, in some of them, some of the courts won't do that. But let's take the practical example that Ted put out, you know, and that was, you know, the light cigarettes. Every package of light cigarettes bore the descriptor lights. People went in and asked for a light cigarette. And it was clear, it was so clear that Congress in the 1960s said that the phrase light became so embedded in the public mind as associated with less harmful because it had supposedly less tar, that it was understood that light was a synonym essentially for less harmful.
No, I think that shows exactly the issue you've got here, because there are many people out there who didn't, and it's the class device
who
lets you paper over the individuality of what they knew. There are many people out there who had read and knew that if I bought those, they're dangerous.
Well, but that's an interesting question, because the public health community didn't come out until 2001 and say it wasn't until the tobacco industry released their documents onto their website that they were able to determine that the tobacco industry had withheld information
sure.
from which they could make the medical determination that these cigarettes, in fact, were no less harmful.
And to Ted's point, the people out there continued to buy them after that information was out there. So how can you possibly say it's that piece of information that was the cause of them buying them in the first place?
Well, could it be the fact that they're addicted and at that point you can't stop buying anything?
Maybe an issue in that case, but there's a lot of other cases like that out there.
But let's take
but
that.
But it's the class device that's papering it over.
Number one, papering what over? The substantive violation is whether or not there was a fraud committed and that the companies knew that they were selling a product that did not have the properties it was being marketed as. And if you sell a product in that manner, is there not a means by which you can combine all of those consumers who bought the product on the basis of the truth of the representation? Why is the class device papering over anything?
It's papering it over in many cases. And I'm not saying it necessarily is in that case, but in many cases. I mean, I think it is in that case, but I think it's even clearer in other cases where because of the class device, the individual consumer doesn't have to show that the alleged fraud had anything to do with their purchase in the first place.
But isn't that, as you said, isn't that a matter of what either the law says
or
the courts say require as a matter of proof?
As I said, if you go in as an individual, no court in its right mind would avoid the question of did you see the ad in question.
Well, that's simple.
Let's even assume arguendo that Michael's right and that the tobacco companies committed fraud in those cases and egregiously deceived consumers into smoking cigarettes they never would have smoked otherwise. Then why is it that we want to compensate the lawyers to tunes of billions and people who've suffered no personal injuries to tunes of more billions, essentially bankrupting the cigarette industry over plaintiffs who have not suffered cognizable injury?
Well, why do we want to reward the tobacco industry for bilking or defrauding consumers of billions of dollars by selling a product that never would have been sold had they told the truth?
Again, it's a causation issue, and the fact that when these cases actually go to trial, the economists get up there and say 90% damages rather than something reasonable, I think suggests what's really happening in these cases. But
I'm not saying that the class device hasn't been abused, but I think there really is a delusion in believing that there is no such thing as corporate fraud. If you want to talk about class abuse, there's also marketing abuse. And the proposition that I would like considered is if there is a marketing abuse which is employed by a corporation to sell a good under false pretenses, is it your position that there is no judicial mechanism other than individual suits?
No, I wouldn't say that. And I don't think there's anybody here who would say there isn't corporate fraud. I think anybody who has a home email account knows that there's corporate fraud. They get the emails every day. But to the extent that there is a problem with corporate fraud, there are mechanisms to take care of that through the Attorney General system, which has been, it's not like Attorney Generals are shy animals. Attorneys General. And with respect, and I think there is a problem for using the class aggregation device. It is just necessarily, there is not a good way to divide the abusive class actions from the non-abusive class actions, and I think consumers are hurt in the long run because of the abusive class actions.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, if anybody's got something, like there at the back.
Try to bring it back to the Act for a minute. One of the concerns kind of late in the game when some of the compromises were struck was that some provisions put in to preserve things that weren't class actions but resembled them, like mass actions or private attorney general actions, that was potentially creating a loophole that would allow some of these to migrate to those forum that had been class actions pre the passage of CAFA. Has that happened at all? Or are we seeing any evidence of that?
I have not seen much evidence of that. I think that there's been a little uptick in activity of attorney general actions where some state attorneys general have retained what are basically private plaintiff's law firms to assert claims as AGs. That arguably is an evasion of the statute, although some of that was happening before CAFA was enacted. I've not seen much on the mass tort side to avoid federal jurisdiction and create those clusters. In fact, because the statute had in it the mass tort provision that I think warded that off. One interesting decision that has come down recently, and I mentioned it only because his name was mentioned earlier, was Judge Weinstein has an opinion recently, and I don't want to overstate it, but it was a mild endorsement of CAFA from a source I wasn't expecting, and indeed he proposed that CAFA be amended. I guess that question was asked earlier, to expand federal jurisdiction to take in mass torts more generally so that you wouldn't have competition between state and federal courts with respect to those. And so I think implicit in that was some recognition that that aspect of the statute wasn't complete in all respects and that the mass tort arena would be well served by having some way to gather more of those actions in federal court.
Anyone else have any thoughts on that issue? Okay, well, if that's the case, I'd like to thank our panelists again for participating today, and thank all of you for coming out in such bad weather. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.